Worker camp. When they finally, the way they got a lawyer out to contest this action of the judge, they had a couple of real longshoremen, boatmen, waterfront men. They went up the Penny River, this side of Penny River way, and they sent this lawyer from, he was an attorney for the Wild Goose. I can't remember that man's name. But anyway, he stayed at counsel most of the time in the first early years here. But he went up there, you know, and the gang didn't know anything about it. He's going up the beach, you know, but that wasn't no boats up there, as they know. So when he got up there, the Oregon was, Kimball Company had something to do with the Oregon, and she went up, so instead of going right south, she went west, northwest, you see, and they rode out, and it was pretty tough weather. And they picked him up, and so he got outside. Well, he didn't. They picked up this lawyer. These are longshoremen. They got $200 for rowing him out in this bad weather, see. I knew them both. I knew they were real waterfront men, see.
And Colonel, was he the lawyer who later became a lawyer for Al Capone?
No, Albert Fink, he was from Kentucky. He was very clever, but I never really trusted him.
No.
And he was a attorney for the company, for the Pioneer. The Pioneer hired him, I think, because Charles Johnson. By then he might have been for the Wild Goose. Charles Johnson might have been, Judge Johnson might have been for the Pioneer, because he lived up in that Magnus Chelsberg house.
Yes.
And he was a very fine man. Well, it was like that, you know. You never knew. But that they got him out, and that's the way he. Then the next year they brought in. When they didn't cease and desist, and this order was sent in, by the Circuit Court of down San Francisco, they sent marshals in here and arrested both him and Dudley DuBose, and they brought him outside, and each one of them got a year in jail, and he got lost his job, of course, and I don't know whether McKenzie got caught or not, because I didn't keep close enough tab on the case, but I know that Noyes was let out and spent a year in jail, and so did DuBose. DuBose was a pretty shrewd piece of goods himself, and they were all out to make a buck. They were all out to make a buck, yes, sir. Yeah. And there was plenty of money here and one thing and another, and it, like when they, I know when the volunteer firemen put on a dance, why they'd bring a manager of these stores up, and they'd find him $100. And he'd pay the $100, and that's the way they pulled on their dances, one thing or another, see. And we had, well, there wasn't a saloon that didn't have anywhere from two to three bar workers in it there, and then the dance halls had anywhere from 10 to 25 girls working in them.
How many dance halls were there?
Three. Yeah. And they'd, and the gambling games, you know, were going all over. They worked, there were 24-hour shifts on them, you know.
Well, now, you were a young fellow, only 25 years old. Tell us a little bit about the gambling halls, what the smallest stake was.
Well, the smallest stake was 2 bits.
Uh-huh.
If the game was running. But if you went and wanted to start the game, you had to buy $5 worth of chips, see. But if the crap paper was running, they'd take a 2-bit bet, you see. And I was going to church one night, and the fellow had given me $5 a couple of days before to gamble with, and I had 2 bits left, and I started at church that night, and I didn't like to go and put 2 bits on the plate, see. So I thought, well, I'll go up in the Hunter on my way to church, and I went in the Hunter, and I win $42. So I went up, and I gave him a dollar, and I came back, and I won $210 when I came back, so.
You did all right with your $210.
One night I went down to the Commerce, and I went up there, and I had 4 bits, and I went over to the crap table and shot 2 bits in crap. So I went, here, that's no good, you see. So I took the 2 bits over, and they were down to a turn on the fair bank, and I called the turn for the dollar, and I win it. I called it Jack 6, and it came Jack 6, and I got a dollar and a quarter, and I start in. I win $152 on the next deal. And So we just went out and spent it. That's what you do, you know.
Easy come, easy go.
And you're young and foolish. You didn't know any better, you know. That's and you had no home. I was 3 years in this town before I was ever in a private home.
Well,
yeah.
You live in a tent?
I lived in a tent, and then I had a little cabin that I bought. But out in the hills, I lived in a tent by stacking snow up around us, you see. And a tent will warm up the quickest of anything you ever saw, you know. We had those little Lang stoves, and heaven's alive, but they'd get hot off of quick. And
a little pot-bellied?
No, it's regular, just regular. Frank Lang, after he went down, opened up and made stoves there in Seattle. He invented this stove and made it up here, and all the natives, they just, well, that was something out of the world, because when they came down here, they used to gather this, what they called squaw wood, just chips of wood and twigs and all this and that, and they would cook they would take boiler seal oil, and they'd mix up this dough and cook this dough in the seal oil, you see. But when they got those stoves, well, they could bake, they had a bake oven in them, and they could bake in it, and they could cook on top, and oh, heavens, well, the native, he had to buy one of those, the woman thought of that. I know a fellow told me up at a trader, I can't think of that fellow's name either, but he had one of the first traders in Kotzebue there, and he told me he'd got a chance to buy a lot of tents. Some fellow had bought them at a bankruptcy sale, and he took them up there, and he got $25 and $30 for them, because in the summertime, where they would dig down in this sand, their houses would all get damp in the summer, see, and they'd move out, and they would put up a walrus hide with sticks, and that to break the wind. And that's where they'd live behind that, because they're damp in their houses. But when those tents came, they're calico houses, they called them, and the Holy Mackinac, that was something out of this world, you know. They all bought those, and so that I found out that there was no trouble at all to live in a tent in the wintertime. If you banked it all up with snow, and you had your stove in there, and you'd save, you know how when you're burning coal oil in a lamp, how there's always some slimy stuff gets in the bottom? Well, I'd throw that in the can, and in my old canvas gloves or anything, I'd throw that in there, and I'd have my kindling all chopped and ready, and I could reach out of the bed, pardon me, to throw one of those in and light it and throw some wood on it, and then I'd throw it to, next thing you know, well, I could get up and dress in a nice warm room, see.
What kind of wood did you have?
Out in the hills that way, why, I'd have wood that I'd picked up from, what if they'd boards that had spent an old one, and lots of times I'd cut dried willows and have those for to start with, dry the willows. And so.
Yeah.
In fact, I cooked for John Drake up on Quartz Creek, and he'd hauled lots of willows up and had them stocked, and I have to go cut my willows, and I kept them piled up behind the stove, so they always had lots of dry ones, and then I put the green ones on top to kind of hold the fire, you see. But I had to do all that and do the cooking, just the same thing. I learned how to cook, too.
You're a good cook.
Yeah.
You used, in the wintertime, of course, you didn't have fresh supplies, so I suppose you had a sourdough kettle. And
oh, I had a sourdough. I had one sourdough cup that kept going for 12 years.
Really?
Yeah. I got one out here now.
Uh-huh.
But I haven't used it for some time because I don't eat so much anymore, you know. Well, I used to eat 5 or 6 sourdough hotcakes. Well, if I eat 2, it's more than I want, you see. And so that I can just take this prepared flour and whip up some hotcakes pretty quick by breaking an egg in them. And that time, well, we had these desiccated eggs, you see, and you usually have to have them for eggs, you see. And had these potatoes all crumbled up, and I never could make any of those potato slices. I never, the German, I never could use those at all. I never knew how to, got any way I could cook
them. The dried potatoes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were so many people up here who have since become world famous, like Tex Rickard and Jimmy Doolittle, and, numerous ones. Could you tell us anything interesting about these men?
Tex Rickard was as likable a man you'd want to know. He certainly was a likable fellow, and he and Billy Turner had the gambling concession in the Northern. George Murphy, he just rented it out, his share out to them, see. And they backed the gambling games. And, oh, Texas bet on anything. He'd bet on a fly, whether it'd light or wouldn't light or anything else. He's a natural born gambler. He's a pleasant, agreeable fellow you'd want to know. I know him very well. And I knew all the dealers. The bald-faced kids, they all used to say that he dealt ahead of the building of the AT&SF, the That's in Topeka and Santa Fe. He was around dealing for a bank, and when they built the ATM, that's what they used to say about him. And Dutch Charlie and French Frank and all those, every one of them, you know. Patty McDonald, he had three or four houses they rent, and he dealt for a bank right along. Furbank is really the first gambling game you can play. So it's the only advantage they get you is you're calling the turn, and then they take half of a split. Uh-huh. And that's the advantage they have.
Not much way they can fix the game, though.
No, but they tell me you can deal double out of it, but I never saw anybody do it. But a fellow named Mickey Barlow told me about a fellow that Courtney that was here that he could deal it, and that he knows that. So don't ever play in front of him because I never played heavy enough to make it worth a while, but there's other fellows who go in there and they buy $100 stack right to start with, you know, and all like that. But I'd win and maybe put down $1 or call it a turn. If I'd win, well, I'd have $4 and I can have something to go with, you see. And I'd have $5. You got to win. If you call the turn, well, they pay you 4 for 1. You bet $1, that's who you'd win for. You'd have $5 to start. Well, if you put markers around, and as long as they didn't shoot, double shoot the turn on you, well, you could call up pretty fast, you see.
Was it in Nome that Pantages got
his start? Pantages was Dawson.
He was Dawson.
You know, they used to handle it for a long while. They didn't have money there. It was all gold dust.
Yes.
Well, in weighing out on these scales, why, they dropped some, and he got the job of sweeping up the floor in two of these saloons, and he'd pan out that dust, and that's where he got his start.
Well.
Yeah. All that dust that went up. You know, in the places that they melt gold and silver for the make jewelry with, every so often they'll waste down the walls. And just what has been gone out in fumes and settled on the walls, why it pays to do it.
Well, that's amazing.
Yes, that's what I say, you know. Well, everybody theorizes about how placer gold comes. Well, when I worked on Iron Creek, I worked on a good rich claim there, too. I've seen that gold just as black as your hat. Well, now, all the geologists and all the mineralogists that I've talked with, they all say that this Imrock Lake up there, it was just the crater of a big volcano where all that lava that's round up the country came from. Well, now, supposing that went off, supposing it blew up in the wintertime, and all the gases in there had gotten so heavy they blew the top off, didn't they? Mm-hmm. Well, now, don't you suppose that gold had been fused and silver and all these other minerals that had been fused and gone off into a gas? And then went up there when it struck the cold air? Why, of course, it came right back right now. That's the way I figure a lot of this placer gold. That may be crazy in the head. I might be foolish. It may be all wet to think that, but it looks to me that's because in all of the quartz that I've ever worked with, I've never seen a nugget in it. I found flat gold in it, but I never found any nuggets in it like that. But these nuggets were out on the claim that I worked on that I own out here. Why, there's nothing in the world to find dollar and three and four and five and $10 nuggets right along. Well,
what was the largest nugget that was found in around Nome?
That was when I found over on Discovery, and it's a. Got a picture in one of these, I don't know, 3,000, 3 something, 2,500, I think was the amount of it, yeah.
Good-sized
nuggets. Yeah, it was a big one, yeah. Good one, okay.
You were here during the Alaska commercial days, or part of them, at least.
Well, they came here, but the individual drove out on the companies here, because their manager got a salary, and all their clerks, and the manager didn't have much to say. They'd give him three clerks and give his salary. He'd make his allotment to pay that, whatever he had. And an individual, he'd start in, you know, and in the wintertime, if their trade wasn't there, why, clerk hunted something else to do. And he did it. And that's why the companies couldn't compete with him.
No.
They just could not do it. And a lot of them, their clerks were crooked. They would sell it, and you pay them, and they wouldn't go on the books at all, you see. There's been about between 120 and $130 million of gold taken off of this peninsula. And of all the men that taken that, and I know they've taken it anywhere from 20 to a million, not a one of them has left anything here as a token of appreciation of having made the money here. And old Kip Lathrop, he told me, he says, Charlie, Alaska's been good to me, and I've tried to spend my money where I got, and said the more I spent, the more I got. And I'd like to see that been done here, but it hasn't.
Well, there are two hardy ones like you, Charles Davenport Jones, who have stayed with Alaska. I've been working with you for the last 4 or 5 days, and I want you to know that I have come to admire you a great deal, that I have found that you are a poet of no mean value. You're a born historian, a fine politician, and a true pioneer, and I want to thank you for that.